Like all faculty members and most pastors, as you will learn when you get into pastorate, it is hard to come up with a decision on what to preach on. Most of us take an easy out by deciding to preach a series. That way you only have to come up with a topic once, and then you've got several sermons that you can work out of it. So I won't be any different. I'm going to try a series as well. This series will be on the miracles of our Lord. The length of this series is indeterminate at present, but I trust, Lord willing, that there will be at least two sermons in it, and probably will run on for several years, as most faculty sermons do, faculty series do. The goals in this will be to look over the miracles which Jesus performed during his earthly ministry to tell us several things. Some of these things will help us to know more about Jesus. Some of these things will help us to be able to examine the situation in our own day. We'd like to find out what Jesus' miracles tell us about miracles that come from God, as opposed to miracles that come from Satan or miracles that are faked, something of that sort. The only way to be able to test today whether miracles are going on would be to at least see whether the kind of miracles God is doing in Jesus' life, how they compare, how they differ with what might be claimed to be going on today. And another thing that I think the miracles tell us a great deal about is they tell us a great deal about Jesus himself. They tell us about who he is and what kind of a being God is. And those things, I think, will be helpful to us also. They tell us something about the power of God and how Jesus, as the second person of the Trinity, has this power. What they tell us about the character of God and what they tell us about the purposes of God. So this particular series, I'm always better at trying to do them exegetically than trying to do them topically. That's the way we want to attack it. We will take different times a particular miracle, or if there be a couple of miracles that are very similar, a couple of them, and deal with them, and then extract from them certain things that they may teach us in this direction. So for this morning then, for these few minutes we have, turn with me, if you will, to John chapter 2, and we would like to look at the miracle at Cana, verses 1 through 11. John chapter 2, verses 1 through 11. And on the third day, there was a wedding feast in Cana of Galilee, and Jesus' mother was there. But Jesus also was invited, and his disciples, to the feast. And when the wine had run short, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no wine." Jesus said to her, "What is that to you and to me, ma'am? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to him, "Said to the servants, whatever he tells you, do it." And there were six stone water jars standing there for the Jewish cleansing, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to them, "Fill these jars with water." And they filled them to the brim. And he said to them, "Now take some out and carry it to the master of ceremonies." And he carried it, and they carried it. Now when the master of the feast tasted the water, which had become wine, and he didn't know where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, he called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone first serves the good wine, and when men have drunk freely, the poorer wine. You have kept the good wine till now." Jesus performed this first of his signs in Cana of Galilee, and he revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. That's the miracle we want to look at this morning. I want to say a few words about background. Then we want to look at the miracle itself, and then we want to try and say a few things about its significance. What about the background of this miracle? Well, wedding festivities back in ancient Israel were a much more exciting phenomenon than wedding festivities today. Usually you go now and you sit through a 10-minute service, 15-minute service, half-hour service. Then you stand in a waiting line for 25 minutes to shake the hand and kiss the bride, etc. And then you go in and you get three peanuts and a small piece of cake and a little bit of juice, and that's it. You go home. 2 hours. Well, back then, the wedding festivities lasted up to a week. You weren't there all the time, of course. You went home evening. But the wedding festivities lasted up to a week, and there was a big feast that was held the first day of the of the wedding, actually kind of in connection with the actual marriage itself. And then the other festivities weren't feasting all the time, but at least entertainment of various sorts. So wedding festivities were much more elaborate at that time. And there was at least as much concern at that time that the family that was putting on the wedding save up and really put on an impressive wedding that people would appreciate it. In fact, the burden of expense in those days fell on the groom's family, not on the bride's family as it does today. So the groom's family would often save for years and years to have enough money to be able to afford to provide all of the food and everything that hundreds of people might be consuming all day during that first day of the wedding feast. So that basically is the background on wedding festivities that we need to know something about here. Now, you can hardly get away from a passage like this without having to say something about wine, so we have to need to say a little bit about the background of wine in ancient times, too. I'm not going to try and represent the idea that there was a special meaning of the use of the word wine that had no alcohol in it or something of that sort. I don't think that is supportable from the historical background that we have in the Old and New Testaments, in the other material from that period. As far as we can tell, wine at that time was made the same way as it is today. You wind up with a product, if it's competent product, you wind up with a product that's 10 to 15% alcohol. But what a lot of people don't realize is that wine in ancient times wasn't drunk like it is drunk today. In ancient times, for some unbeknownst reason, which we'll come to in a couple minutes, after making this wine at that alcoholic proof, instead of putting it in a distillery and cranking it up to 50%, as some people would do today, they poured water in it and cranked it down to a much lower alcoholic level. So, in fact, you find dilution amounts in ancient writings running as high as 20 to 1, 20 parts water to 1 part wine, in which you hardly have any alcohol in it, down to about 1 to 1, where you knock the alcoholic content in half. The usual dilution, however, that was used was 2 to 1. We find this very commonly in Greek sources and very commonly in the Talmudic sources, no explicit mention in the scripture about this matter. And that means that you take 2 parts water for every 1 part wine, you mix the stuff together, and then it is drunk. So the alcohol, which starts out at 10 to 15%, the wine, which starts out at 10 to 15% alcohol, winds up at 3 to 5% alcohol when you actually sit down to drink the stuff. And that would come down then in the ballpark of modern beer. And there may well indeed be some problems with modern beer, but at least there's nothing like the problem with that sort of material that there is with wine or with whiskey, things of that particular sort of problem. And you can see this, I think, when you take the amount of alcohol that a person has to have in the bloodstream to become noticeably erratic and then over to what we would normally call drunk, and you convert that into how much wine you need to drink in this diluted state to produce this result. So what you find out is that a person needs to drink 6 to 9 cups of this kind of wine to begin to show the influence of the alcohol upon his system. And to get what we would call drink, get what we'd call drunk, you would have to take about 12 cups of the stuff. So for a person to get drunk at a wedding party or something, they have to drink 3 quarts of the wine in order to have that happen. So we should say then that the wine situation is rather different in antiquity from that direction. And the fact that they kept diluting the stuff suggests that their major purpose of drinking it was not to get drunk. If your major purpose of drinking is to get drunk, you're going to concentrate it like the barbarians learned to in the Middle Ages with using stills and such, which have come down to modern times. So that shows something different. Another feature that's different here, there's been a huge technology change from ancient times to modern times. So that today, we can preserve fruit juices without them becoming alcoholic. We can heat them up and can them and kill material that would spoil it, and we can keep things a long time. Those techniques were not known, as far as we can tell, in ancient times, so that was not available to them. Besides, the whole matter of preserving the fruit juice so that you could use it, I mean, you could just pour it out if you felt badly enough about the matter, there was another procedure to be considered as well, and that is that it was known in antiquity and agreed upon today that wine mixed with water improves the water. But today we don't think much about it because all of our water is mixed with chlorine, And so it's already had a lot of the stuff killed off in it that would be make it dangerous to drink. But in ancient times, the chlorine that was used in water was wine, which probably had a better taste than the chlorine we use today. But that was a situation, and that needs to be taken into account. So I'm not going to get into a discussion of teetotaling or abstinence versus moderation, that sort of thing, but just showing you that there were some differences in ancient times. But if a person believes it would be sinful of Jesus to produce something that had alcohol in it, he's going to have a tough row to hoe to show that that there was no alcohol in ancient wines. Well, that much then on background regarding wine. I'd refer you to a very valuable article in this area that appeared in Christianity Today back in June 75. I think it was the 20th of June issue, a work by Robert Stein called Wine Drinking in New Testament Times, where he develops the evidence, which is quite good, on the dilution of wine in ancient times and the view of drinking straight wine as barbaric. Well, we need to turn to the miracle now and look at that. In the miracle, we see what Jesus does. He takes six jars of water, and these are 20 to 30 gallons apiece, so we come up with about 150 gallons of water and converts it into good wine, presumably 150 gallons of good wine. So that is actually the miracle. I'd like to make a few points regarding this miracle. points which I think are characteristic of Jesus' miracles in general. One of them is that Jesus' miracles were not frivolous. We're not frivolous. If we look at all the miracles of the New Testament, this is probably the one that would come closest, if you think about it. Others, he's healing people, or raising people from the dead, or delivering people from danger, things of that sort. Here, no one is apparently being healed. No one is being delivered from any great danger. And yet, I still think it's possible. It's fair to say that Jesus is not being frivolous in this miracle. Running out of wine like this in the middle of a festivity like this would be a great embarrassment to the people who were hosts, the family that was host to this. We don't have any idea who they were. It wasn't Jesus, by the way. The Mormons represented this as being Jesus' marriage, and he was being married to several wives and things of that sort. But you don't have to look too hard at the passage to see that that gets bombed out. What on earth would Jesus to say to his mother, "What is this to you and me about running out of wine," if in fact his family, being the groom's family, was responsible for providing the refreshments at the situation? Why would it say offhandedly Jesus was also invited if he happened to be the bridegroom? Bridegrooms are not usually invited to the wedding. So I think it's quite clear. I don't know how big modern Mormons are on this, but it was made something of by earlier Mormons, that this is not Jesus' wedding. Yet the miracle is not frivolous. Here is a group of people, probably not of any great means. Otherwise, they'd have had plenty of wine there. They would have been sure to have enough if they had a lot of money. One can guess that we have a family here that had scraped together their money to have enough to have a good feast, and then something went awry. The price of wine was steep that year. That can happen. A season where it's not real good and it's very expensive. That does not change the appetite of the people who come to the wedding feast, as you might be well aware. Or it may be that they thought they had enough, and twice as many people showed up as they thought they were going to happen. That somebody else had a wedding scheduled for the same day, and so they figured they could get by with less, and that was canceled or something. Who knows? But the point is that in the middle of festivities, the wine runs out, and Jesus' mother apparently is helping out or something, perhaps even as today, a lot of the women folk come and help out with the refreshments and things of that sort. She might have been something of that sort. Anyway, she comes up and tells Jesus. And Jesus, to save the host's embarrassment, steps in and does something for them that bails them out of a really serious difficulty, which would have really harmed their reputation for the rest of their lives, perhaps. And perhaps does suggest that this family was relatively poverty-stricken. So I think we can say that even in this case, Jesus' miracle was not frivolous. It deals with a real need, and he does it, and does it in a way that is, I think, honoring to the Lord. Now, secondly, I think we can say about Jesus' miracle is that it's not ostentatious. Jesus does not make a big show of doing this. He doesn't say, all right, bring those water pots out here in front of everybody. Now, folks, I'm going to show you one. Let me roll up my sleeves, get out my magic wand, and I'll wave it a few times over it. No. Very few people at first even know what has happened and who has done it. Just the servants who had come back to help roll the water pots out and put the water in them and that sort of thing. They realize that something has happened. The host, the master of ceremonies, as I'm calling him here, the master of the feast, thinks at first that the bridegroom has all this extra stock put away. He doesn't even know they're out. Sends off the servants to go see about it. They find out they're out or something, and when they come back with the new stuff, he thinks that that the fellow, for some unaccountable reason, has kept all the good stuff back and brings it out now, which is just the opposite of what is usually done. So Jesus is not ostentatious in this area. I think he's following his own advice in Matthew chapter 6, where he says, when you do your righteousness, don't do it before men to be praised by them. Don't make a big advertisement of what you're doing. And so it is true, of course, that Jesus is doing this miracle to demonstrate something about himself, but it's a miracle that arises naturally out of the situation he's in. He does not manufacture a situation to do it in. The situation occurs, of course, as God. He's controlling history, so I suppose you could say manufactures a situation, but not like the average sort of a person who's putting on a show would set up something. Or as in a stage magic, the fellow has all these tricks, but they don't usually have anything to do with the basic needs and concerns, the audience, anything of that sort. It arises naturally from the situation. It's not clear that Jesus ever held healing meetings in the sense of advertising people to come in for healings and things of that sort. Rather, he proclaimed the word of God to them, and when he began to heal some people, people began to flock to him for that reason. When he began to feed some people, people began to flock to him for that reason. And in fact, he rebukes the people who came to him. He doesn't rebuke people who came for healing, who are sick, but he does rebuke the people who come to him wanting to see wonders, and the people who come to him wanting to be fed again. Remember his remarks after feeding the 5,000 in John, where he says, you all aren't coming to hear my words, you're coming to get your stomach filled. When people hear there's a free handout, they flock to look for it. And so I think we can suggest here that God's control of history allows Jesus to introduce his miracles where they're appropriate, rather than dragging them in by the heels. Jesus does not act for the purpose of making a sensation or for self-aggrandizement. He, in fact, cast himself down from the pinnacle of the temple so that a huge crowd would see him falling down, plummeting down to earth, and suddenly stop and land smoothly in the ground and say, hello, I'm your Messiah. Let's go wipe out those Romans. He turns away from that whole temptation and, in fact, operates in a way to present before them the evidence of who he is, to make them think about it, but not just in an ostentatious way, but to make them judge on the basis of righteousness, not judging on the basis of some great sensation. So two things I think we can see about Jesus' miracles. They're not frivolous. They're not ostentatious. There's a third thing we can see about them, too. They're not done in a corner. That's Paul's phrase. When on trial before Agrippa, he said, Agrippa, you know about these things. They weren't done in a corner. Now, one of the characteristics of magic tricks is they have to be done in a corner. When a fellow is going to make a whole automobile disappear from your sight or an elephant disappear from your sight, he does not go out into the middle of the city square with people standing all around on all sides and say, now this elephant will disappear. Poof. Instead, he has a carefully constructed stage. And everybody sits with a certain angle back here in the audience, and the stage goes back into here, and you see some kind of louvers, and you see a truck or an elephant or something parked back in there. And he waves his wand, and there's a flash of light, and it disappears. And what you don't realize is that a whole set of mirrors shaped like the louvers have rotated, and you're now looking at the side of the stage, and the elephant, truck, or whatever is still parked back there. And it is characteristic of fake magic in general that it has to be done in a corner. It has to be done under carefully controlled circumstances. And yet Jesus is not operating in that way. It is true that Jesus refused to do miracles selfishly. And it is true that he refused to do miracles at the beck and call of the Pharisees or anyone else. But he did do miracles, and he did miracles that were open to public investigation. Take this miracle here as being open to public investigation. Jesus apparently only had 5 disciples at the time. It would have looked somewhat suspicious. Surely many of the hundreds of people in the audience would have noticed it if Jesus and his five disciples had secretly slipped in with 150 gallons of wine. So you have some complications in that direction. Besides, a number of servants saw what happened. They saw the whole thing. And besides, this miracle does not stand alone. Jesus did hundreds of miracles before opponents, before people who were favorable to him over the whole period of his ministry. So Jesus did not do miracles secretly. We might even paraphrase Matthew 24, verses 26 and 27, to explain to us what Jesus is doing in his miracles. Paraphrase, you understand, having very little to do with the original text. If they say to you, "Behold, the miracles are being performed in the wilderness," do not go forth. Or, "Behold, they are being done in the inner rooms," do not believe them. For just as lightning comes from the east and flashes even to the west, so are the miracles of the Son of Man. When the Lord did his miracles, they were open, obvious, and could not be disputed that they were miraculous occurrences. So I think we learned these things from Jesus' miracles. We must rush on very quickly to what the significance of this miracle that he's doing is. This miracle and the miracles of John in general are called semeia, or singular semeion, signs. That's the term that John regularly uses in his gospel. It means something which conveys information, and in this case, miracles which convey information. What sort of information was Jesus intending to convey by his miracles? Well, John tells us at the end of his gospel that these signs, many other signs Jesus did, he said, which were not written, but these signs were written that you might believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that in believing this you might have life through his name. The miracles were done to convince you that Jesus is the Messiah, that he's very Son of God in a unique way that does not fit anyone else. John says something similar in the beginning of his gospel, John 1:18. "No man has seen God at any time," he says, "but the unique God," that is referring to Jesus, "who is in the bosom of the Father, he has explained him," he has revealed him. Our explanation of what God is like comes to us in the person and work and words of Jesus Christ. So that, I think, comes through. And Jesus himself says that, John 14. "He who has seen me has seen the Father." If you see and understand who I am, what I'm doing, you understand who the Father is, what he's doing. Well, let's see very quickly just a few things about Jesus and about God that we see in this miracle. We see, first of all, Jesus is pictured here in this miracle, shown to be in this miracle, as God, and as God the creator and sustainer of the natural world. Just as God providentially makes the vine to produce the grape, and the grape to produce the juice, and even the juice to produce the wine in a few months, so Jesus, for the purpose of illustrating who he is, carries out the whole process in just a few seconds. A picture then of the "Here's the one, here's who I'm from, here's who I am, the one who makes the grape and the juice and the wine that man cannot do." I mean, we talk about men making wine, but men don't make wine. Men sit around and watch something else make wine. So, and that something else is something which God has created and which God controls. So basically, we see that right here. Jesus as God, the creator and sustainer of nature. And just as God made the natural process, so God can bypass the natural process. And here Jesus bypasses the natural process, but makes the same result in just these few seconds. We see another thing important about God, I think. We see Jesus as God, the joyful one. It's very easy to think of God as one who's looking around to see if anybody's having fun and putting a stop to it immediately. As one who's a killjoy, one who does not like frivolity, and perhaps he does not like frivolity, but one who does not like entertainment, things of that sort. It's very clear from Jesus' whole ministry that he was not that kind of a person. That although Jesus was sinless, as no other person has ever been, yet he attracted people to himself. And that's a hard problem we find, of how can we be as sinless as possible and still attract people to ourselves. That's a problem which Jesus solved and which real righteousness can solve, that we can attract people to ourselves, even sinners. And that's a tough thing, too. He can attract even sinners. He's not an ascetic person. Here we certainly see that he considered marriage to be an honorable thing. He would not go into a marriage if he didn't think so. That celebration has a real place in life. He was willing to attend celebrations, meals, banquets, things of that sort, and we see him here. Not that Jesus says there's anything wrong with asceticism in the sense of fasting now and then and of living on a low budget and that sort of thing to do good, but there's nothing super spiritual about it. It's not something which, if you're really going to be spiritual, you'll be that way. Jesus wasn't that way. He fasted, of course, various times, and he wasn't a spendthrift, and yet he certainly was willing to give this great gift to this married couple, and he was willing to have an expensive amount of a large amount of perfume poured upon himself as a recognition of glory, of the joy that a person had in forgiveness. He's one who made the good things to be enjoyed and has joy and expects that we can have joy as well, even though we realize that that'll never be perfect in our sinful condition. We can see Jesus here as God, the great giver, as well. I have an involved calculation here of figuring out what these 6 jars of wine were worth, but it comes down fairly straightforward. Calculation, you can find out from, say, Smith's Dictionary of Greek and Roman Antiquities, that the price of wine varied considerably in antiquity. As you might guess, it varies considerably today, but that it was about 2 days' wages for an amphora of wine, would be about 5 gallons. And so 150 gallons of good wine would be worth at least a month's salary for an average laborer. And that means the whole salary, not just what he has to spare after feeding his family. You can see why it's expensive for a family to try and set up for a big wedding like this. Yet Jesus gave this couple a gift of 150 gallons of good wine worth a full month's wages. So Jesus, the one who gives, because God gives. We can't give anything to God, really, but God again and again gives to us. There may be some symbolism here, too. Already, by New Testament period, those who studied the Old Testament and who thought about things had begun to suspect that the banquets and stuff connected with sacrifices in the Old Testament, the wedding feasts and that sort of thing, were symbolic of something that lay beyond. And so you find the rabbis, as well as Jesus, picturing the eternal state and the time of the coming of the Messiah as a great banquet. And it may in fact be that Jesus picks up a little bit of that symbolism here in his coming to a marriage feast and providing the enjoyment, if you like, at the wedding feast, in hinting that he is going to be the one who brings the real messianic banquet and the one who will provide the real joy in that. There may even be a hint here of Jesus' atonement. I'm not sure about that at all. But the very strange remark of Jesus to his mother, "My hour has not come." Did he mean his hour for miracles hadn't come? Well, he did one, so apparently he didn't mean that. Presumably what he meant by his hour has not come is that the time of his death had not come yet. And what on earth would that have to do with this picture, except that Jesus himself later in John talks about people drinking his blood, and if you don't, you have no life in him. Apparently a picture of partaking of his atonement, and this phrase, using the phrase drinking, and the term blood suggests that a connection with the Lord's Supper, which later has that same connection, and a connection with the whole matter of his atonement. We don't know, but we do know that John is the gospel which contains John's whole lifetime of thinking about some strange things that Jesus said and trying to figure out what they meant in the light of what Jesus did and coming to some of these things. So it may well be that here he has picked up for us and hinted to us that Jesus is in fact prefiguring his whole atonement and the results it will produce in bringing people to righteousness, bringing them into a time of great joy represented by the messianic banquet. What can we say in conclusion then, very quickly? We can see something about Jesus' style in doing miracles. Jesus is one who left his miracles open to test, though he would not do miracles merely for the purpose of testing. Jesus was one who didn't do frivolous miracles, didn't do ostentatious miracles. They were miracles that met real needs, and they were miracles that really fit in what was going on. And Jesus, in doing his miracles, demonstrated to the people around him who he was, that he was very God, and what God's character was. In this particular miracle, we see God as creator and sustainer, God as the one who is more joy than we have, and that the real joy comes in sinlessness, not in our sin. And that Jesus, and as God, and God himself, are the one who give and give and give, rather than the one who needs that anyone else should give him anything. Let's pray.